What do we do when American presidents undermine democracy itself? This might seem like a contemporary question, but it's actually been a live issue from the early days of the Republic. Corey Brettschneider tells this story in the new book, The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. Corey is a professor at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, and he's written for The New York Times, Politico, The Washington Post, and Time. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
My name is Corey Brettschneider. I'm a professor of political science at Brown University and a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. My book is The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Have Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. Many books about presidents emphasize their virtue. And the idea of these books is to tell a kind of top-down virtue story in which the great ideals and virtues of these presidents trickle down to the people. But my book takes a very different approach. It focuses instead on their vices. And specifically, I look at how five United States presidents have threatened democracy. And that tells us something in turn about a danger of the presidency itself, that the very office is a threat to democracy, given its enormous power and the power that it places in one individual. But this is also a book about hope. In times of crisis where democracy is threatened, the virtue exemplified by citizens drives the recovery of our democracy. Citizens, I argue, not public officials, have often defined, defended, and championed the idea of democracy. And importantly, they've done so by recovering a democratic meaning of the United States Constitution. Although we often take for granted fundamental principles and rights within our democracy, the book argues that democratic ideals like the right to dissent, the notion of legal personhood extended to everyone, regardless of race, the notion that in a democracy we are entitled to equal protection and that that is inconsistent with the notion of second-class citizenship, and the idea that no person is above the law, didn't just come to pass through the writing of the Constitution or through the arguments of our presidents or Supreme Court. Instead, they were notions that were championed, defended, and realized as a result of citizen action. There are five big ideas in this book. And the first of these big ideas is that the right to dissent is fragile. This is an idea that's often taken for granted. It's thought to be in the Constitution. But our second president, John Adams, rejected the idea that the right of free speech in the First Amendment is a right to dissent. Part of why he rejected it is because he thought that the very idea of popular sovereignty, that we were a government of we the people, was not the right way to understand the American system. In fact, he thought that the president of the United States was more akin to a monarch than a democratically elected leader. Monarchs meant stability for their nations, and it followed from this idea of a president of a kind of monarch that critics couldn't be allowed to simply criticize the president of the United States. When John Adams and his party were caught trying to undermine the election of 1800, and citizens fought back, Adams' party passed, and Adams himself signed the Alien and Sedition Acts. What these acts did was make it a crime to criticize the president of the United States. But importantly, they allowed for criticism of the vice president, Thomas Jefferson, a member of the opposition party. These were not neutral free speech limits. They were instead an attempt to shut down multi-party democracy itself. But the heroes of that moment were not the Supreme Court. In fact, one of the most prominent Supreme Court justices advocated for the Alien and Sedition Acts and participated in the prosecution of the editors who criticized Adams. Instead, the heroes came from the people themselves. They included the newspaper editors who found themselves prosecuted for their criticisms, and they celebrated these prosecutions as acts in defense of free speech. They publicized the transcripts of these trials, sometimes in newspapers, and they advertised the fact that they were being prosecuted. And part of how they defended themselves was to point to the newly passed First Amendment. They wouldn't find vindication in court, but they would through the election of 1800. And that election, with pressure from the editors, became a referendum on whether or not the right to free speech was a democratic right to dissent or something much less than that, as Adams would have had it. And in that battle, the editors prevailed with the election of Thomas Jefferson and subsequently James Madison. And with that victory, too, came the enshrinement of the First Amendment as a right to dissent in the American consciousness. So when Madison found himself under pressure to shut down the opposition party, this time because of an ongoing war, he refused to do so, a believer in the idea that, as the editors had claimed, the right to dissent was enshrined in the American Constitution. The second big idea of the book is that we cannot trust courts to defend our most basic rights. Instead, courts have often been in league with presidents to attack democracy, and it has been citizens who have fought back. James Buchanan ran for president on a principle of neutrality on the question of slavery. But secretly, he lobbied the Supreme Court to decide the Dred Scott case in a broad way that would deny Black people legal personhood under the federal Constitution. And when that case came down, denying that Black people had the right to personhood under the Constitution and pushing back against Congress's ability to limit the spread of slavery, he found himself opposed by a formerly enslaved person. Frederick Douglass was not only an orator, he was one of our greatest constitutional theorists. He read the document, looking closely at its text, to argue that it contained moral principles that undermined the court's decision, not only in Dred Scott, but generally when it came to the rights that all Americans should enjoy under the Constitution. He argued, for instance, that the preamble itself spoke of we the people, not we the white people. And he did so in order to bring out here and in other places the democratic idea of the text of the Constitution. Now, this was a very different way of opposing Buchanan and the court from many abolitionists. Many abolitionists saw the Constitution as a pro-slavery document, as a kind of pact with the devil. And Douglass instead fought back, vindicating the idea of the Constitution and arguing that courts should not be left to define it. Ultimately, the vindication of Douglass's ideas after being persecuted by Buchanan and having to flee the country came from the presidencies of Lincoln and really especially the presidency of Grant, who he allied with, making clear that Black people had not only a right to personhood under the Constitution, but extending it to an idea of equal protection and a right to vote. The third big idea of the book is that it is citizens, not scholars of the Constitution, who often can spot and see its fundamental morality, because in their rights denial, they often have the most skin in the game. Woodrow Wilson had been a scholar of the Constitution before his presidency and before he was governor of New Jersey, and he championed an idea in his books and in his lectures, and I looked in depth in this book at his lecture notes that are housed at Princeton University in the notes of his students, he argued that the Constitution was fundamentally a document devoted to national efficiency. And he argued that national efficiency was incompatible with what he called friction. Once he won the White House, Wilson justified the segregation of the federal government on grounds that it was promoting efficiency and limiting friction. But journalist Ida B. Wells and journalist and activist William Monroe Trotter confronted Wilson in a White House meeting. Specifically, they argued that far from promoting efficiency, what this resegregation was doing was enshrining an idea of second-class citizenship into the Constitution and nationalizing the idea of segregation. Wilson fought back. He said that if they saw second-class citizenship in his actions, that was due to something they were imposing. But they resisted, arguing that separate was inherently unequal. That, of course, would be an idea that sparked a civil rights movement and eventually would be vindicated in court in the Brown case. And we should see Brown not as its own victory, but as a vindication of that much earlier argument, in which citizens saw the principles of the Constitution decades before the jurists of the Supreme Court. The fourth idea of the book is that no person, not even a president, should be immune from prosecution for their crimes because of their high office. Or in other words, this is the idea that a president is not above the law. And as I record this, the Supreme Court is considering the issue of presidential immunity, an idea that's been embraced by bipartisan presidents like Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton. According to the idea of presidential immunity, when in office, a president can't be prosecuted or indicted for even the most serious crimes. And right now, the court is potentially going to expand that idea to protect presidents even after they are in office. But during the Richard Nixon presidency, the grand jury investigating Watergate saw things quite differently. Vladimir Pergelj and the other jurors of Grand Jury 1 rejected Nixon's claims to immunity and executive privilege, and they insisted on their right to hear the Watergate tapes. And after they had considered the evidence, they even voted to indict the President of the United States. In fact, juror Elaine Edlon recounts that when Pergelj had called a straw poll of the jury, some jurors raised two hands to show their enthusiasm for indicting Nixon, and all voted to do so. Richard Nixon's pardon by Gerald Ford wiped away the chance for these grand jurors to complete their prosecution of the president, and although Vladimir Pergelj had protested, there was little that he could do at that point. And so the idea that a sitting president can not be indicted is the way we tend to think about things at this moment. But still, a different vision is found in history. The citizens of Grand Jury 1 stood for an idea still not vindicated, that the president should be accountable to the law just as any other person is. The final big idea of this book is that in order for people to see their ideas of the Constitution realized, they need to form what I call constitutional constituencies to galvanize behind future presidents who will be devoted to democratic restoration. As much as many of the people profiled in my book opposed non-virtuous presidents, they still believed in the system, and they sought to vindicate it by supporting candidates and more virtuous presidents who would restore democracy. The newspaper editors prosecuted by Adams sought vindication of Jefferson and Madison. Frederick Douglass allied with Lincoln and later Grant to ensure that his ideas and those who backed him were realized in the Constitution. And the ideas of Trotter and Wells were eventually adopted by presidents like Truman and Johnson. In each of these cases, these citizens and readers of the Constitution galvanized a constituency behind them who eventually joined up with future presidents to recover the Constitution. The presidency of Richard Nixon, as I noted, was very different. We really haven't recovered from that idea that a president is immune from prosecution. So what will happen in the future? If we are to restore democracy, that mechanism should and can be found again of bringing candidates and future presidents to champion the ideas of the people. That has worked repeatedly because constitutional constituencies and their leaders have galvanized their ideas and their political power behind candidates and presidents who will restore democracy. But in our own time, we face a grave new democratic threat. And it's not clear where this constituency is. We need a new constitutional constituency to emerge from the people, to champion American democracy, and to ensure its survival. What form that constituency will take and how it will happen and who it will be made up of all remains to be seen. But if the people do not coalesce, the country may fail to recover from the current democratic crisis.
Thank you, Corey. That was Corey Brettschneider with 5 Big Ideas from The Presidents and the People, 5 Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. Also check out our bookbite for The Situation Room, the inside story of presidents in crisis by George Stephanopoulos. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.